way, but something mulched up out of his thought. His anarchist thought. Anarchist in the best sense of the word. Oh, so many times he stood up in front of Federal District Judge Ritter, that old fart, and he'd be picked up for picketing illegally, and he never pled innocent or guilty, he pled anarchy. And Ritter'd say, "What's an anarchist, Tennessee?"
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. My name is John Malkin, and the name of this program is The Great Leap Forward. This program is devoted to exploring nonviolence and anarchism, social change, and spiritual growth. You can hear The Great Leap Forward Wednesday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. here at 96.3 FM. We're also on the internet at www.microradio.net/FRSC. I have a very, very special guest here today, Utah Phillips. Very happy to have him here in the studio live today, Free Radio Santa Cruz. Welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz, Utah.
What? I'm glad to be here. Real radio.
Boy, I'm not hearing you on...
You're not hearing me on it? Am I plugged in?
Let's find out.
Wiggle this. Well, not coming through your headphone, huh?
No, and what we'll do just to deal with that quickly is something like this. Thanks for being here.
Sure, I'm just delighted to be here. This is a real radio, seat of your pants radio, by God. I love it. I'm so glad you folks are still on the air, and may it last for years and years.
And you performed last night here in Santa Cruz at the Kumbwa. How did that show go?
It went very, very well. I found out, by the way, what Kumbwa means in Swahili. It means a starving club owner. I like playing there, but I've been coming back to Santa Cruz for 30 years. I mean, I used to play over at the Laurel Community Center before it became Loudon Nelson. And I sang on the street here. I just love the town. I especially like coming down to the boardwalk and just walking and listening. I love to listen to people and the sound of the language being spoken by large bunches of people. I'm the guy that figured out how to swing that hammer to make that bell ring every time. There's a trick to it, you know. And God, that guy on the boardwalk got so mad at me when I would stand there in his line and say, "When you get up there, this is what you got to do." And he kept ringing the bell over and over again, and he was going to call the cops.
We were just talking earlier about Jewish storytelling and your history. Maybe tell me a little more about that and maybe some stories that you grew up with.
It was in Cleveland, Ohio, where I was born. My mother and father divorced when I was about five. My father was a communist, youth organizer, and he sold the Daily Worker on the streets. My mother had worked briefly for the CIO, Congress of Industrial Organizations. They're both radicals, but I think it was a tenant union strike, near as I can tell, asking questions. There was a lot that my mother would never talk about. I didn't know my father hardly at all. But everybody was living in a tent. I have a brother older than me by a year, living in a tent in this tenant union strike. No future for two small children, two infants, you know. So my mother left him, and she became a fashion model. You know, what does a single woman do with two children? She had been a beauty pageant winner in high school, and she became a fashion model for Higbee Brothers in Cleveland, walking the runway upstairs at the top in the lunchroom, you know, or the dressing room backstage. And that's where my brother and I, were kind of stashed. Oh, that was beautiful. I'm glad I've thought about this for years. My brother and I would sneak away two little kids, and we get on the elevator and go all the way down to the basement of Terminal Towers, Higbee's, because that's where the big trains came in. That was the train station underground there. And the big steam locals, the passenger locals, would come in, and I'd go down to the head end where the engine was. I mean, the drivers, these enormous engines. You couldn't, a grown person couldn't touch the top of those drivers. And it, just before they were going to start, the engineer yelled, "Board!" And then they'd vent steam, and I would become enveloped in this cloud of warm steam where I couldn't see anything wrong. It was like being in a fog bank. It was marvelous. Well, my stepfather, Sid Cohen, a young Jewish businessman, he just graduated from University of Pennsylvania, and the young guys would go have lunch at the roof of the Higbee brothers to watch the models. And so he fell in love with her and courted her off of the runway. And that was quite a commitment for the son of immigrant Jew, Simon Bialobzeski. Name was Cohen. Why? Because same old story, you know, I can't spell your name. What's your tribe? Cohen. So, you know, he's Sid Cohen. For him to marry a Shiksa with two children just out of college and move us into the old Jewish neighborhood next door to his father, Simon. So there we were. You know, that's where I spent the first 12 years of my life. And it was a wonderful one. It was so full of juice, so full of life. There was people on the porches in the summer talking and playing Yiddish records. And a lot of them, there were still hand-crank Victrolas. During the Second World War, when there was gas rationing, there were still horses in the street. The rag man, you know, the coal scuttle, the vegetable wagon. And they just never did give up the horses. You know, why bother? You're going to ration gasoline. And it was just an exciting place to grow up with Simon. Simon was Orthodox. My grandmother, Lily, wasn't. She was, no, I don't know quite what Lily was. She was younger than Simon. Simon would sit at the end of the hall. My first memories of him was he had cataracts. And the doctor said, he was getting cataracts, some eye problem. And the doctor said, if you sit at the end of the hall, and he gave him a prism, and you put something at the other end of the hall, in this case it was some dried flowers in a pot, and you hold that prism up to your eyes and practice bringing the images together, you won't have to have an eye operation. So every morning, on rising, Simon is at the end of the hall, this tiny man, very old, with the prism focusing on those dried flowers. And while he was there, my mother would come across where Lily was, my grandmother, and together they would fry up bacon in the kitchen, and they would eat it quickly before Simon came in. And one of my first memories as a little kid, you know, 5-6 years old, was to come across from the house next door to wondering where my mother was and find in the dead of winter my grandmother Lily and my mother standing in the kitchen flapping their aprons to get the smoke out the windows. Place was freezing, you know, before Simon came in. Simon, my memories of Simon are in the living room of that house during the Second World War with his ear glued to the curtain on the front of the Atwater Kent, the big stand-up radio. All those old radios had a short wave band. And he's there, his ear right up against it. He was hard of hearing, and he was turning the dangle, just trying to pick up any news about what was happening in Europe because his whole family was there, you know. And he sold home heating oil, and he spent most of the money he saved for retirement trying to get people out of Poland, and it didn't succeed at all. He didn't. When he retired, he had very little because he had given it up. But watching him, I didn't understand then what he was doing, but he was so fixed. There was a terrible storm. Lightning came through the front room window, set the carpet on fire right at his feet, and he did not pull his ear away from that radio. My grandmother came in and poured water on the rug from the kitchen. And that's how, you know, he was. I haven't thought about these things for years. It was a whole different life because we moved to Utah. I mean, my God, you know, moved into an all-Mormon town. And it was 1947, and that was a centennial of the Mormon Pioneer Trek, the entrance of Brigham Young to the Valley. So the whole town was full of Mormon Pioneer stuff. What do I know? You know, nobody explained this to me, why these people are behaving like this. And a neighborhood where the boys in that neighborhood were so snotty and so quiet. They were quiet. Nobody was yelling. There were no alleys to run through. My God, if you're going to grow up civilized, you got to have alleys to run through, for crying out loud. You know, where are the alleys? So it was a hard time for me, you know, getting used to the idea of being in Salt Lake City. Fortunately, my mother sent me to the Boy Scouts when I got old enough. Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts they took place at the wards, the Mormon wards. It's like a parish. It was over Garden Park Ward on Yale Avenue. And then she discovered that they wouldn't let black kids into the Boy Scouts because it was controlled by the Mormons. So she pulled us out, you know. And then a lot of other parents said the same thing. Big Jewish community in Salt Lake, two of them, Reform and Orthodox, and had been for years. So the parents formed a camp, Yeladim, the Jewish youth camp, JOI, Jewish Organization of Youth. And we had our own meetings, and I did acquire a Jewish peer group. They were spread out all over the city, but not in the neighborhood. And we had a Camp Yeladim, the children in Hebrew. And it was a Jewish youth camp that met in the summer at the Methodist College because it was out. And my camp counselor was a Japanese Hawaiian, Tetsuo Okada, who managed a French bakery on 13 Thieves called Piero's. It was a very, very eclectic environment. But see, he's the one who taught me to play the ukulele. And the first one to start teaching me to play the guitar. That's where I begin, you know, kind of begin doing this, playing the ukulele. And then I said, I want to learn the guitar. So he gave me the guitar, and he showed me how to play it. And it was only like 2 years later when I was up in Yellowstone, I went up on a freight train to find summer work, you know, working in the kitchens during high school, that the guys on the road crews, these old drunks who knew a lot of songs, old Jimmy Rogers songs, they heard me playing and said, "What is that?" And see, Tats thought the guitar was always tuned into a Monoloa G, slack key. So the first guitar I learned in Utah was slack key Hawaiian music. And they showed me how to retune the guitar so I could play, you know, civilized gringo music. And that's when I started writing songs, listening to what they were singing. So I guess that's how those two things come together. I can go on forever like this, you know, but why bother?
You know, my grandparents were Jewish socialists, and I'm curious how Judaism and socialism and communism helped to shape who you've become and the sort of work that you do and the sort of stories that you tell, and also when you first encountered anarchism.
I think I was always aware, through my mother and through the Hubermans, We the People, you know, radical histories. Way before Howard Zinn, there was a book called We the People, and it was a radical history of the American people. It was blacklisted. The book was blacklisted. When I would come home from school, Doan School, with my history book, and write a little paper, one-page thing about history, out of that book. If I got a passing grade, my mother would tear it up and say I failed. She would give me the Huberman's book and say, "Here, write out of this." And I'd take that to school, and they'd say, "This isn't acceptable." She'd say, "Congratulations." So I always known that through her, even though she wasn't raised Jewish, that the backbone of American radicalism was with the Jewish Bunds. The Bismarck Order, expelling the socialists from Europe, and they came to Chicago, formed the Butchers Union, formed the Bakers Union. It was a strong backbone of the labor movement was Jewish, a great deal of, and that's, you know, that's always been in my consciousness that was true. The strongest movement among Jews in the 1890s was the anarchist movement. There's a wonderful movie about that called The Jewish Anarchists. I have a copy of it at home. It's a wonderful movie. The tragedy of that with that long radical Jewish tradition here in this country is that when the Balfour agreements were confirmed, when Britain finally gave Palestine to the Zionists, you know, and brought Churchill's dream came true. Churchill said, "We need a European enclave on the shores of Asia to protect our interests." At the end of the war, after the Holocaust, it became very, very difficult to be a Jew in this country and not be a Zionist. And so that undermined Jewish radicalism very, very seriously because it was their own unique kind of blacklist, you know. To talk about Palestinian liberation, to talk about not an ethnic state, talk about Israel as multi-ethnic secular democracy, not a religious state, and lose, you know, simply lose that perspective. So that's the pickle, you know, that Jewish radicals are in now. I'm glad that there's a lot of Jews have organized, like the Mideast Children's Fund up in Berkeley, that marvelous work, Jewish radicals, Jewish Reds. That'll come around. I think that anarchy, though, now, you know, I didn't know the word. I've always thought that there should be a different word. I mean, not that the word has been, of course, been stigmatized ever since the Haymarket in 1886, when they began to characterize anarchists as bomb throwers and extremely violent people. Anarchos, without a ruler. Okay, fine, as far as that goes. But no, we're talking about self-rule. We're talking about becoming your own government. The president of the United States of you, and you can do it better and cheaper than they can. So what do we call it then? What is self-government? Is it egoarchy in the Greek? But then there's that ego carries the pejorative. So let's come up with a different word that really describes what we're up to, you know. Ammon Hennessy, when I got back from Korea, I just roamed around drunk a lot, didn't know if I could live in the country anymore. And Ammon got me off of the trains. I was working in a warehouse in Salt Lake. Ammon came west, one of the Catholic worker people, Dorothy Day's people, and opened the Joe Hill House, named for the great wobbly songmaker. And I worked out there for 8 years with Ammon Hennessy, who's a Catholic anarchist, pacifist, draft dodger in two world wars, tax refuser, vegetarian, wise guy, one-man revolution in America, what he called himself. And he took me over, you know, dried me out on a marathon picket line, and convinced me that I love the country, just like that thing you were playing there, and taught me about, he didn't tell me what to do, he did by example. He lived and behaved a certain way, and I saw that this man was happy, this man was productive, this man was able to tell himself what to do. He didn't need somebody to tell him what to do. He said an anarchist is anybody who don't need a cop to tell him what to do. There are all kinds of cops in the world, teachers, preachers, parents. Anybody who feels they have the right and ability to tell you what to do is some kind of cop. But if you assert your right and your ability to make just and humane decisions in every area of your life, and when you blow it, you look at it as an opportunity to change, and you do change, then you're starting to become an anarchist. Ammon came to me one day and he said, you know, all we ever wanted to do was to create voluntary combinations among ourselves. We want to create combinations that serve our needs as we define them and not as they're defined for us. We need to have combinations that are not culturally compelled. And we've grown up in a world of cultural compulsion, as Calverton's phrase, where he said to me, look, he said, you're wearing socks. I said, yeah. He said, they're both the same color. I said, yeah. He said, why? Why are your socks the same color? Did you choose that when you took them out of the drawer in the morning? He said, no. He said, that's cultural compulsion. And that hits you 1,000 times every day, and you don't even know when it's hitting you. See, you've got to sit down with a notebook and take a whole day apart, you know, and see how much of your behavior was really compulsive and how much was really voluntary. So having dealt with a cultural compulsion, you want to start building combinations with other people as a self-ruling person. And try to get the work of the world done through voluntary combination, non-coercive combination. He said, if you and I, it's the Joe Hill House, if you and I can agree to do our share of the work of our world here, around here, if you and I can agree to take only what we need and put back what we can, if you and I can agree to care for the afflicted, and if you and I can agree not to hurt anybody, all the things you can't get from the boss, you can't get from the state, then we can begin to form that voluntary combination and start to get the work of the world done without the boss and without the state. That's an anarchist.
And part of anarchism is compassion and nonviolence. And yet, a common view now of anarchism is it's a synonym for violence and chaos.
Yeah, hell, you know, the president, you say something to the president or one of the politicos, say, let's try this. Say, no, if we did that, it'd be, that's, you want anarchy? you know, as chaos. Well, hell no. Anarchists have got to be the best organized people in the world. If you're going to become your own government, you got to be damn well, you know, good at organizing. And if you're going to organize voluntary combinations, cooperatives, and collectives, you're going to have to be, you know, well organized. Of course they have it wrong. Of course they got it wrong. Problem is that there are too many people calling themselves anarchists who act out a lot, who interpret anarchists in their terms. You can't tell me what to do. Oh, yeah, you can't tell me. I'm going to do whatever I damn well please, you know. If anybody gets in the way, I'll knock them down. No, that doesn't work. That's a blueprint for self-destruction. You're talking about nihilism, okay? And part of our task is not just to talk to people about what anarchy is and who anarchists are, but to talk to the nihilists and try to wean them from it back to anarchy, you see, to where we are working together, to where we are learning to make non-coercive contracts among ourselves about how we're going to behave and how we're going to do, as I say, the work of the world without the boss and without the state. Compassion is a really big part of that. Of course, nonviolence. I mean, good heavens. The man can escalate from a cop with a handgun up to a hydrogen bomb and everything in between. He owns that game, and he's always saying, come up that road with me, you know, the armed struggle. And then he greases you, and you're done for. Either that, or if you win, you've got the guns now, and you start pushing people around. The state, you know, recreates itself. So, no, you have to take another road, a road that doesn't know, a road he doesn't understand. It's the road of nonviolence. See, nonviolence is not just a tactic or a strategy. It is a practical necessity.
Sometimes there's criticism of nonviolence, especially towards North America, the criticism being that we have privilege and leisure and time to actually be experimenting with nonviolence when there's people in other parts of the world that don't have that privilege and need to take up arms. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that? And also, we were talking earlier a little about how the notion of revolution, of big change, has changed. That the idea of overnight revolution by taking over power structures has not worked. And by taking over the weapons of those in power and owning those weapons is not really a place of power anyway.
Lenin said that revolution consumes its own children. Why? Because the people who go through the experience of revolution, the horror, the degradation, the need to kill, render themselves unfit to govern people. The post-revolutionary governments are very often those violent, and I think we can witness that in most any revolution. I can't tell people what to do. They want a revolution, have a revolution. But spare me no illusions about this. Spare me no illusions. I was glad the Sandinistas won. You know, I wished I could have been down there, you know, with the Sandinistas. Like I told Gary Crystal, a great Trotskyite up in Vancouver, British Columbia, who'd been down there. And he said, boy, you should have been there for the big celebration. I said, I wish I'd been there at the victory. But still in all, I'll be there and I'll cheer. I'll help anybody who wants to better their life. But when they win, I'm going to go back to where I'm staying and open the secret compartment and take out my disguise and my forged papers and try to beat it to the border before they come for me. I have no illusions about the state. I have no illusions about the state. Liar and a butcher. The state's a liar and a butcher. And we have, 8,000 years of history to prove that. We need to do something else besides the state.
What's your impression of the Zapatistas and Subcomandante Marcos?
Revolution is being redefined by Subcomandante Marcos, being redefined globally. It's a noble movement. It's a whole new idea, set of ideas about a populist organizing, about behavior, the way people treat each other, the kind of structures that they build cooperatively, about participation. It exemplifies what Che Guevara said about revolution. Che Guevara, didn't he say, at the risk of seeming absurd, the true revolutionary is moved by profound feelings of love? Wow. Doesn't that hit you like a ton of bricks? Why? So, I know. I guess I sound kind of like a Pollyanna. And yeah, how do you deal with complex economic issues in the through what I'm talking about? I don't know. I don't make rules for the world. I can't make rules for the future. I have no post-revolutionary analysis. It's not up to me to figure that out or impose it on anybody. I simply want to get together with people who feel and want to live their freedom without hurting other people and build with me combinations of which we are the architects.
Utah Phillips, in the liner notes for the CD, one of the CDs you've done with Ani DiFranco, The Past Didn't Go Anywhere, in a section that you wrote here, it says, the Buddha's students asked him, are you a saint? He said, no. After a while, they asked him, are you an angel? He said, no. Then what are you? They asked. The Buddha replied, I'm awake.
Oh, yes. Wake up. Wake up. That's all. Just wake up. You know, get out of yourself. Turn your eyes outward. Beat the streets. Ask questions. That's a wonderful thing to do. That's what I do with my elders or with anybody. Is what I was doing with you today. Is to people most of the time, the only questions they ever get asked is, how come you're late or how soon can you get it out? And they go through their whole lives. People could be married 40 years and watch the same television news broadcast and never turn to each other and say, hey, honey, what do you really feel about that? So people have these thoughts and feelings and ideas and opinions all ganged up inside, and nobody ever asks about it. You start asking questions about that. Of course, first off, they're suspicious. You know, are you trying to sell me something? But once you convince them that you really mean it, you really want the answers, boy, they unburden. It starts to flow out, you know. And that's my university. That's my college. Just asking questions and following my nose. The great gifts that we have, I guess the four gifts that we have that we need to preserve that are hammered out of us by our school system, by our culture, cultural compulsion. First, we have the gift of curiosity, which I never gave up. And the other gift, of course, is mnemonic, the gift of memory. Mnemosyne is my goddess, the goddess of memory, daughter of the Titans, Kronos and Gaia, time and earth. Memory. And then method. How do you organize this flow of stuff coming through? What are the patterns? What's the geometry of this? Logic. And then those three, and then the fourth one is endow everything with a profound sense of play. I've never given those things up, and I'm very happy with my life.
You're a great storyteller, and you mentioned television, and I was thinking about how television was being sold as the great instrument for storytelling, and it's turned out, how has it turned out?
It's turned out a great many stories. Madison Avenue has learned how to tell stories. Madison Avenue has studied the psychology of storytelling, the depth method, motivation analysis, stories, the archetypal stories grounded in sex, death, and the other. Classical storytelling, they've learned how to beat that to death. There are too many stories, but they sell products. They've learned how to jerk us around. The key right now, the key building block to a nonviolent future, a nonviolent family and community, is to turn the goddamn thing off. To take your one final fit of violence, pick your TV up and throw it out in the middle of the street, and then learn to live in peace with each other. And open your mouths, sounds will ensue, arrange them in a cogent form, subject, verb, predicate. Talk to each other. My God, it'll be a blessed relief. You will. Get rid of those ugly, exploitive images that are hammered into you by highly manipulative people. Yeah, one of the seeds of peace is getting rid of the television set. The stories. There's an old story of that Peace Corps fellow in Africa who. Well, they left a TV set behind when the Peace Corps left in this village, and the fellow went back 5 years later, and they weren't watching the TV. And he had asked the headman, "Why aren't you watching television?" He said, "Because we have a storyteller here." And the fellow said, "But doesn't the TV know more stories than your storyteller?" And he said, "Yes, it does know more stories than our storyteller, but the storyteller knows me." It's all the difference in the world. So, you know, your parents, your grandparents, your neighbors, they all have the stories. What's the substance of their life, of their real life? Not their opinions about politics or stuff they read in the paper or pick up CNN or Fox. What's the truth of your life? What's the truth of your job, of your tools, of your kin, of your neighborhood? What's your really life like? And you'll always get the truth. They'll always tell you the truth, you know, there. The rest of it is all kind of hearsay. So get busy, folks, and start asking questions, you know, real questions, not rhetorical questions, not questions where you think you already know the answer, but real questions. Turn your curiosity loose and just don't give up learning. Don't give up learning.
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. My name is John Malkin, and I'm very happy to be speaking with Utah Phillips today here on 96.3 FM. The Dalai Lama has said that his religion is kindness. What's your religion?
It was, who was it? Havelock Ellis? No. One of the English naturalists on his deathbed had a reputation for being extremely irascible. Nonetheless, his dying words were, "Try to be a little kinder." Lovely. Of course. Sometimes it's extremely difficult. But reaching for the best in somebody, always dealing with the best and dealing with the worst only when you have to, only when you're driven to it. And sometimes you might be driven to it. Acknowledging that like Ammons, when I criticize a cop, he'd say he's a good man doing a bad job. He said, there are no bad people. There are good people doing terrible jobs, doing terrible things. So one of the reasons for trying to learn to think that way is you lay down an awfully heavy burden. And once you've dropped that, you can think more clearly. You can see more clearly. And I think you can act more constructively. We need to build, not destroy. So much revolution destroys what the workers have built, what the people who led those true lives had built, those true things, those buildings and this library and so on. We can't tear down our own stuff. So that's a part answer, I guess, if I meditated on it. So much of what I think that guides the way I behave, I've been with it for so long that it no longer has a language. It no longer has words. That's just fine.
September 11th, 2001, the World Trade Center was destroyed and a lot of people died there. The Pentagon was attacked. Since then, the U.S. government has bombed Afghanistan. Thousands of civilians have died there. And it looks like the President of the United States is sending more troops to Iraq now and preparing for substantially increasing attacks on Iraq and even beginning a full-fledged war again. What's your impression of all of these events?
War is hell, you know. The country is really in the hands of assholes, you know. I mean, we know this. It's fallen in the hands of assholes, and I don't need to be told again and again that they're assholes. I know they're assholes. It's just obvious. So how do you deal with chronic incipient assholery? You know, how do you deal with the corporatization of the executive branch of the government? It's behaving like a corporation, and corporations are anti-democratic organizations, and that's becoming more and more pervasive. Well, you resist. Campbell, it's on that record, said, you know, the freedom is something you assume, and then you wait for somebody to try to take it away from you. The degree to which you resist is the degree to which you are free. That's what we'll be doing here on the 18th in San Francisco and in Washington and cities all over the country. The mother of all nonviolent demonstrations. To try to punch through to mass media finally and say, look, the support for this war is paper thin. They don't care what your statistics say. They lie. Out here, none of us talk to people out on the street or in our families that are in favor of this war. It's hard to find somebody who's in favor of this war. So what are you telling us? You know, again, it's a corporation behaving like a corporation. Doesn't care. So, you know, any more than Enron cared about selling energy, you know, at exorbitant prices. And they say, screw the people. What's what these people are saying? You know, we don't have to listen to them. Well, yeah, you have to listen to us. You have to listen to us. The numbers will grow and grow and grow. During the first Iraq War, there was an air raid shelter called Amaraya. And there were over 400 people in there, the families. And one of our missiles hit it square, bored right through all the concrete and killed everybody inside. Last week, the families of people killed at the World Trade Center stood with Iraqis that had lost their relatives in that the wreckage of that air raid shelter, and they held a common prayer service to join hands, and they spoke to each other. That's anarchy. That's anarchy, the best face of it, the best face of it. And it's through that kind of action that we can win. You know, there are people that are over there that are Quakers, that are Jews, that are, you know, people that are now standing at the gates to the power plants, they're standing at the gates to the water treatment plants, they're in the hospitals as guardians, and they're not going to leave with the bombs drop. They're not going to leave, you know. There's a fella that's in an orphanage over there in Baghdad now. His name eludes me. I don't remember names very well. But he won the Congressional Medal of Honor in Vietnam, a chaplain who carried 22 wounded GIs out and saved their lives, gave them the Medal of Honor. The second time he was arrested at the School of Americas by crossing the line, he sent his Medal of Honor back to the government. And now today he's in an orphanage in Baghdad saying, maybe what I learned in Vietnam can help me to save somebody's life here. Okay, we will cleave to these people. You know, they are our true people. They are our true people. So we can't lose heart over these things. Yeah, there's a massive amount of force and a massive amount of destruction looms on the horizon, but we can beat it. We can win. I can't say that too often. The biggest act of repression that happened in this country was the Palmer Raids of 1919. The Espionage Act passed during the First World War. Thousands and thousands of people in jail. People being lynched and hung from the telephone poles because they had German last names. The Sedition Acts. It was far worse than anything we're experiencing now. Far worse than the Patriot Act. And we still came out of it with the CIO, industrial unionism, all right? We still came out of it. The Great Depression, grinding economic degradation, and the beginning of political repression. And we came out of that with Social Security, with workmen's compensation, with the minimum wage, because of organized workers, rammed it down the governor's throat. Roosevelt just stood out of the way. So he came out of that. McCarthyism, the effort to destroy the labor movement, you know, the beginning of the Cold War. I mean, makes what's happening now look tame. We came out of that at the end of the 1950s with a civil rights movement that won. I was so proud when I was out traveling to be driving, speeding through Mississippi and was stopped and issued a citation by a black highway patrolman. I say, hey, we won. And then an anti-war movement, you know, that according to Richard Nixon prevented him from using nuclear weapons on North Vietnam. Okay, so we're going to come out of this. Come on, we've done it before. And if you think we're not, if you think you got to move to Canada, if you think you got to throw in the towel, you think it's just hopeless, well, you're turning your back on all those people that went to jail during the Palmer Raids and all those people that gave us Social Security and went to the wall for it and all those people that got beat up in Mississippi for voter registration. You're betraying and turning your back on all those people. And wouldn't you feel dumb? Wouldn't you feel awful if you did leave the country? And we came out of this, and it came out better, and you had to come back? Say, well, I guess I can come back now. It's okay. Jesus. No, just keep the faith, brothers and sisters. Keep the faith. This is your sermon today.
How do you feel about a song?
Well, I like them.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that. You seem to hang around them a lot.
Well, let's see. I'd always wanted to write a song for Ammon Hennessy, and I finally did. It's not about him. He was vain, and I wouldn't give him the satisfaction. It was a song mulched up out of his thought as a nonviolent anarchist. The new ruling party is holding the aces. The rest of the cards are all missing faces. I'm sorry I can't know you today. What can one say? I will not obey. Give us your sons and give us your daughters. No one is safe or immune from the slaughter. How indifference makes them rage. What can one say? I will not obey. National Guard or freedom fighters, all houses belong to cigarette lighters. But who hides in the smoke? What can one say? I will not obey. Better perhaps to perish outside of the bunkers where our generals hide. I turn away and spit. What can one say? I will not obey. Give us the minds of your children to learn the substance of books we have not yet burned. But can they read the sky for rain? What can one say? I will not obey. Soon all tyrants will feel our impatience. We choose to create our own combinations. I was always willing to agree. What can one say? I will not obey. The essence of contract is agreement, not coercion or obedience. And agreement is sacred. What can one say? I will not obey. There are so few wars of people's liberation, for the people have so seldom risen, only the armed faction. Listen, the armed faction lies. They recreate the state through their action. When the people rise, it is not they, but the state which dies. I sing this song for the prisoners released, most of all now for the new state police. You see, the guns have changed hands. Again, what can one say? I will not obey.
Thank you. That's really nice. Boy, it's great to have you here at Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Well, this is the kind of radio that we want. These are the people's airwaves. They belong to us, and we have to assert our right to them, like we hang on to the national parks, the public schools, the postal service, all the things that we own together. It's under such violent assault by really just a handful of maladjusted people who think that everything needs to be owned and make money for somebody. And we're seeing that, you know, the conservative political agenda is capitalism only has no use for government now, except for deregulation, privatization of everything that we own, tax relief, and a government or an army paid for at our expense to support their interests globally, which is what they're trying to get away with in Iraq right now. And of course, the final move in that is to say, let's corporatize the government, and then we don't have to worry about those things anymore. So that's the kind of dilemma that we're in, and we have to leap to its defense. And the front line, the trenches of that defense, are right here in this little room with this broadcast equipment. This is our people's voice.
One way that you've resisted the government is by not paying taxes. Tell me about your experience with war tax resistance.
Well, after what I saw in Korea and then talking with Ammon, who was a war tax refuser, that's why I was in court so much, you know, and Ammon, and the judge would say, Ammon, you broke the law. What about that? And Ammon would say, Judge, your damn laws, the good people don't need them and the bad people don't obey them, so what use are they anyway? Yeah, well, then it came along, you know, I've dug up landmines, and all the people are being killed by landmines globally. I don't want to pay for landmines. I want to pay for smart bombs, you know, dropped by dumb people. I don't want to pay for any of that. Oh, years and years ago, going on 40 years ago, I wrote him a letter and said, look, there are some things you people are doing I agree with. You know, like I like the national park. So if you'll tell me where I can send my money, let me earmark it like we do at the United Fund, I'll be happy to do it. And the letter I got back, which I still had, said, if every taxpayer asked for this service, pretty soon there wouldn't be any government. Cool. So they know where I am, and they know where to come and get me. I don't have much of anything, you know. Not a lot they can take away. They can take away my freedom, all except in my head. You know, that can't be taken away. Gay Gadonkins in Fry, my thoughts are free. I would regret that very much, you know, but not doing anything wrong. You know, I don't feel I'm doing anything wrong. I'm doing things right. Most of my work in life, part of the money that I've made, I've given away to things I believe in. And about a quarter of my time on the stage is benefits for things I believe in. And I write it down. I know where every penny went. I know where every minute went. And that's called anarchist taxes. So I tax myself. I'm self-taxing like an anarchist would be. Now, you listen. Folks, you listen to what I'm saying. You become self-taxing. You tax yourself. Or you get together with other people and take your money you'd pay in taxes and put it into an alternative fund. And then have your community submit proposals for how the money should be used. And then you distribute it. Little thing. A 1040 club. Okay? Take $10.40 from your taxes and put it into a community fund. All right? And use it the same way. So that's simple. Take the money. Stop paying your telephone tax. Hell, the phone company doesn't want to keep track of that anymore. They're tired of it. They'll figure it out. Let them deal with it. So, but seriously, you've got to withdraw the largesse these people function on. And that just doesn't mean put it in your pocket and walk away from it. Means you become self-taxing, and you put what you would normally pay in taxes to those people who spend it on bombs and guns, put it to work in your community in combination with other people, voluntary combination, and make it a better community.
I've learned a little Latin from looking at one of your websites, Mors ante servitium.
Mors ante servitium, death before employment. It's a tramp aphorism that used to be on the bindle of Dawdlin Bill, a great tramp up in Montana, up there in Forsyth, Montana. He's a great man. He's a slow man, but he's great. That's what was embroidered on the outside of his Montana bedroll. Mm. He was good on the trains.
Are you still riding the rails?
Well, with congestive heart failure, it's very difficult. I do want to come down and ride here with you hobos from hell, because I am going to need some help. But I miss the trains. I miss the trains with a deep passion. I always rode alone because I wanted to be alone during that period of my life. But there is a unique kind of freedom, being in a clean and empty, or a grainer. It's almost mystical. Nobody can get you. There's no phone, no fax, no cop. You're underway. The engineer, the train is going someplace and you don't know where much. The engineer is like God. He doesn't know you're there and you're not aware of his intentions. See? There's a unique kind of freedom. Anybody who wants that freedom can have it, but you got to pay the price for it. Cold, alone, sick, lonely, nobody looking out for you except yourself. But you can be free. You can be absolutely free. But there's a serious price to pay for it if you want it.
I know that some years ago, I think in 1995, you went to the doctor, and the doctor said that you had had a heart attack.
Yeah, he told me I had a heart attack, and I said, no, I didn't. He said, yes, you did. He looked on the angiogram down the TV screen. You see, there's a whole part of your heart that doesn't work anymore. So they call that a silent heart attack. And he said, must have been a lousy day you missed a heart attack. And so, that was called congestive heart failure. We tried to track it down. My cardiologist in Grass Valley up there in outside Nevada City, when it first started examining me, he said, and what do you do for a living? So I described what I do, you know, town for town, 33 years, singing songs and stuff. And he said, I can quote him, he said, you mean you abandon yourself to the judgment of strangers serially? No wonder you had a heart attack. No sane person would do that. So he understood right away. I never thought of it that way. He's absolutely right. So, he told me I had to stop touring. I was on my way to a long tour through Montana and up to Calgary, and that meant going over 7,000-foot passes, about eight of them. And that's bad for people with congestive heart failure, at least at that stage of it where I was. He said, you do this tour, you're not going to come back. So we canceled it, and for a while I canceled everything. See, I'd go out and I'd tour and I'd do my work, but then I'd come home and sit on the couch for weeks and not hardly be vegetative. And my wife knew something was seriously wrong. She thought I was depressed. And that worried her, but no, as it turned out, I'd simply had, but was running on adrenaline, you know. In fact, my cardiologist said that a heart attack was probably the result of dosing yourself on adrenaline before you went on stage. He said, "Are you worried about performing?" I say, "Look, I'm not a natural. I backed into this trade. This wasn't a trade of choice. I did it because I got blacklisted in Utah and had to find work. I've been sprayed on stage every time I go. It never changes. I'm a worried, frightened performer." He said, "Well, okay, then you just hammer your heart with adrenaline for 30 years, and you know, you pays your money and takes your choice."
Can you describe how you deal with fear? Are there words that you can convey that describe how you have dealt with fear in your life?
I am brave to the point of madness. Fear. Let's talk about the freight trains. The freight trains are part of a complex pattern of avoidance. Okay, so that what frightens you, you move away from. You go away from it. Very often, the thing that frightens you the most is inside of you. Something's broken. And when you try to move away from it, you take it with you. All you can do is keep moving. And that's where the old blown, that's where the jocker tramps come from. There's something buried so deep in there, they'll never get at it. But they're on the prod. You know, there's some piece of pain chasing them around. I deal with fear partly through avoidance. It's just an old habit. I turn my back and walk away from it. I guess my deepest fears is my own capacity for violence, my own capacity for rage. And I have waking fantasies of terrible violence. That's why I'm a pacifist. I was explaining to people last night, because I have to be, like an alcoholic has to stop drinking. And I know I'm a pacifist, too. During the Gulf War, I was knocked off a stool in a bus stop in Cafe in Idaho Falls. I was taking the buses and trains because my car doesn't run on blood. And a guy saw my peace button and knocked me off the stool. And you find out if you're a pacifist somewhere on the way to the floor. I picked myself up and I shook his hand and said, "I'm sorry you feel that way." And then I got on the bus and left. So, yeah, I felt really good about that, instead of exploding, which I, would have done in years past. Yeah, my greatest fears are things that I harbor inside myself. It's for that reason, I moved a lot. I moved through the world a lot, trying to do exactly what I described to you, move away from the source of the fear and the source of the pain and not being able to, so you just keep moving. Comes a time when you make a stand. The minute you stop doing that, the minute you stand still, everything you're running from bangs into your ass, and then you've got to either deal with it right then or you've got to move. And that's when you find your courage. Ammon Hennessy said, "Courage is the principal virtue, because without it you can't practice any of the others." So yeah, you find your courage, and I did, and I was able to learn how to live in one place and learn how to live with myself. There are still dark spots. There are still things that having to do with family breaking up. We were talking about that over lunch, Vera, when I was very young. And I'll never really get at those, So that another part of it is, once you've made your stand, once you've found your courage, once you've confronted it, to really decide there's some things that are not going to change and you can't change them, and just push them aside, put them on the shelf, and as artifacts. So that's what I'm doing these days.
Utah, you've written, "The stories I tell don't just come out of my own life. Many of them come to me from my elders. I strain to hear them through the roar of my own ego, my own needs and desires. But when I became quiet and open to the thoughts and feelings of my elders, I learned that my life story deepens, grows richer, by taking in the stories of those who have led extraordinary lives, lives that can never be lived again." Tell me about that process of quieting and listening to others and asking questions and the importance of listening to elders.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I learned that essentially by doing it. I guess the first elder I ever paid any attention to was when I ran away from Salt Lake to the Navajo Indian Reservation, right on the edge of the San Juan River, and I hid out way out in the desert at St. Christopher's Mission of the Navajo. I'd been there for years and years. It was a red sandstone cloister up against the cliffs. I mean, just nothing but desert around in the San Juan River. And there was Father Baxter Liebler, the Padre of the San Juan. He wore the Navajo bun, even though he had the full cassock. He was from the Good Shepherd Episcopalian Church in New Jersey. Well-born and a lot of money. Got the call. And instead of taking a mule and a Bible into the desert, he went to Cornell University. He quit his parish, went to Cornell, and studied Navajo language and religion under Gladys Reichardt, the great expert in that. And then he went into the desert. And he built his own church with his own hands, did two sung masses a day with the plain song. But he used the words, but he used Navajo and Zuni medicine chants for the music instead of the plain salt. I can still sing some of those. And he always had, he wore the Navajo bun. He was a great friend of the Randolph Banali, the medicine man. I was married in that church for the first time, and it was a terrible, bad thing to do. But he married me, and then Randolph Banali came up onto that altar and did the Princess Cornflower ceremony, and we were married again. See, that's what kind of, Baxter Liebler, remember looking in his crowded little room in that little stone building, and I saw a couple of rusty fencing foils. That was the only sport I ever took up was fencing, and I was a good fencing coach, but I was not very awfully good. I wasn't a competition fencer. I love fencing. And I said, "Where'd you get those?" And, well, he took them out and said, "Do you fence?" I said, "That old man hadn't picked those up for 25 years, and we started fencing in the yard there with the Navajo kids running around, and people, they were saying, 'What the hell is this?' And we're going back to that parry one, parry two, that parry thrust lunge, yeah, crossover, beat, engage, and backing each other up, you know, and man, he touched me and went again and again. I mean, he was fast. And finally, I in exhaustion said, 'Where'd you learn to do that?' He said, 'Well, I got my Latin and Greek at the Sorbonne in Paris, living in a garret, but there was no place to wash. There was no place to take a bath. The only way you could take a bath was by joining the gymnasium. In order to join the gymnasium, you had to take a class.' I said, 'Oh, you took fencing.' You can see he was the first elder that I really listened to, you know, and paid attention to. I realized, this is fascinating. And when I carried that away from there, I went back to Salt Lake. Got the job in the warehouse and the Western Movie Supply. That's sometime later. And there, the boss there was an old man named Earl Lyman. And he was the grandson of Amasa M. Lyman, one of the original apostles of the Mormon Church during the Pioneer Trek. And Earl Lyman liked to tell stories about the old Mormon days. He would come back into where I work, right, a big long table with a roll of butcher paper where I wrap parcels for the trucks to come and carry things away. We were a distributor for movie supplies, cameras and tape recorders. Well, Earl would climb up on my packing desk and lean his back up against the butcher paper and tell stories, just talk. And it didn't take me long to realize that as long as he was lying there, I couldn't work. So I would go to the library after work and look up books of Mormon history and then come in the morning and ask him questions about this. He says, "What about the Mountain Meadow? What about the Morrisites? What about the Gadianton robbers?" He'd hoist himself up there and start yarning, and I couldn't work. That's why I learned the value of storytelling as a part of that pattern of avoidance. And, that was second grade elder, Ammon Hennessy. I met while I was delivering parcels for, you know, Lyman's warehouse, taking some of them to the post office. And Ammon was on a picketing against war taxes in front of the post office, which was also the federal building. And I came out one day, and he was sitting under the bush right by the door drinking water out of a jug. And I sat down next to him, and that's how I met Ammon. And he became the really third significant elder in my life. I guess by that time it was habitual, and I just kept on doing it, you see. Still do.
Did you ever meet Dorothy Day?
I met Dorothy Day in New York City when I first left Utah, and I took M's greetings to her. They were lovely people. Ammon loved Dorothy with a deep animal passion. He was a very, very physical man. Deep animal passion. She loved him with a great spiritual passion. And they used to say in the Catholic Worker about them that the horniest of men meets the holiest of women. And I'm probably telling tales out of school. I shouldn't even talk about this stuff. But so I think Dorothy Day sent him west. You know, get out of here, you know, and go away. Go to Utah, which is off the edge of the world. And he started the Joe Hill House there of hospitality, which is what I was working at. So he sent me back to talk to Dorothy. She very kindly gave me a wonderful first edition of Peter Maron's Green Revolution, the man who taught her, you know, into starting the Catholic Worker. And then she asked me what I was doing in the East. And I said, well, I've been blacklisted in Utah, and I'm going to try to make a living singing songs and telling stories on the stage. And she said, well, just remember that fame corrupts the house of the soul. And that has been my guiding light since, you know, ever since, to not be famous, you know. And people say, gee, you're famous. I say, no, look at that cover of the Inquirer at the checkout stand. You see those people, see those TV? I said, they're famous, aren't they? I say, oh, yeah, but do you know them? No, I don't know them. I say, I may be well-known, see? But I'm well-known, fine, but I'm not famous. You know, it's never my intention to do that. I don't want to be separated. I don't want to be separated from the people that I'm with, that I'm learning from, that I'm singing to. I want to be treated like a good carpenter, a good plumber, a good electrician. See? I do my job, and that's how I want to be treated any better than that. I hate what's happened to the entertainer in this culture. I just want to be treated as an honest American worker applying my trade. And I really work to keep that in perspective. Following her edict, you know, fame corrupts the house of the soul. I mean, hell, when I'm at home, we put the garbage out on Monday and the garbage man takes it away. I turn on the tap and water comes out and it's clear, clean water. I flush the toilet and the waste goes away. Well, there are people working at the sewage treatment plant, at the water purification plant, at the garbage dump, you know, that are, I can't do those things. My life would be miserable if those people didn't do those things and do them well. They do more for my quality of life than I do for theirs. Why isn't anybody out asking for the garbage man's autograph? The folks do that. Next time you have a chance, God, go to your mail person and say, hey, can I have your autograph? You know, we're in this together. You know, nobody should have that kind of elevated position or the kind of, quote, power that goes with that. Dorothy Day knew the value of being powerless but not motionless. Not wanting the power. Not wanting the power. That's why I guess... It's the politics. Some of his dying words 30 years ago when he died was, tell Utah to stay out of politics. Poly is Greek for many, and ticks are blood-sucking insects. No, that you know, all you can do when somebody says, somebody comes at you with that kind of a rap, you say, oh, you want the power now, huh? You want the power? Should I trust you with it? I mean, look at the track record. You know, look at what we've trusted people with power, what's happened to us. You know, why should I trust you with the power? Why do you want the power? And I think anybody who aspires to the power, a position of power where they own and have the ability to use all those nuclear weapons, that person is insane to begin with, to even want it. They're nuts to even want to. So I stay away from it. I just stay away from it. I vote like Ammon. Ammon never went to the ballot box. Never did. Ammon said, you know, his body was his ballot. And at the Joe Hill House, he cast that body ballot in behalf of the poor, the homeless, every day of his life. He paid a terrible price for it, you know. But you can never tell him he hadn't voted. He said, yeah, I voted. I just didn't assign responsibility to do things to somebody else. I accepted responsibility and saw to it that something got done. And that's called anarchist voting. And that's something you can do every day of your life. You don't have to wait for election time, folks. a different way of looking at voting.
Ammon Hennessy also told you force is the weapon of the weak.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, don't you know that? Well, I'll put it in even a simpler way. Old Stupid up there in Eugene, Oregon, old Wobbly there, he had the name Stupid because he was so smart, like they call a fat man slim. And he said, when two people are having a fight, which one pulls a knife first? Yeah, force is the weapon of the weak.
Utah Phillips, do you have another song in you this morning?
No, I don't. I'm starting to get tired. I had a hard day yesterday. I roamed all over town talking to people, and which I love to do. And then I went and did the show, and then got up this morning to do the show out there at K-Pig. I didn't know I was going to be hosting a half an hour of it. They sprung that on me, and then come down here. And I guess I'm just tired. I need to take time out, if you don't mind. I think I would like to wrap this up, if it's all right with you. I'm going to get on the train and go back home to Nevada City. I want to see everybody show up in San Francisco. It may be they were pissing in the wind. You know, it may be that this corporate government just simply stopped listening to the people, and no matter how many people, they wouldn't pay attention. But, my friends, we need each other. Joseph Campbell, late in his life, said, "All we ever wanted is to be completely human and in each other's company." So let's take this opportunity. All you good people, all you people who believe in justice and kindness and humanity and peace, let's get shoulder to shoulder, let's rub hands, let's stare each other in the eye, let's talk together, let's be completely human, and for God's sake, let's be in each other's company.
Thank you very, very much for being here today, Utah Phillips. It's been a pleasure. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM.